This is Steve Tamayo, and you're listening to Ministry During the Disruption. On today's episode, we're doing something that I'm really excited about and that we've never done before, a crossover episode. Peggy Cowenderly, who you've heard on Ministry During the Disruption, also leads something called The Art of Venn. It's a podcast with InterVarsity staff in mind, talking about thriving in life and ministry. And I think some of the interviews that Peggy conducts on that podcast are some of the best out there and will be helpful to you even if you are not on staff with InterVarsity. Today's episode is an interview that Peggy conducted several weeks ago with Andy Crouch, who's a former InterVarsity staff and has a really interesting leadership role and thought leadership role within the Christian community. Andy wrote this article where he talks about this coronavirus, this pandemic, this disruption, and he uses this framework of, is this a blizzard? Is this a winter? Or is this an ice age? That language has been rattling around inside InterVarsity ever since, and it's been so incredibly helpful. Now, on this interview from The Art of Venn, you're going to hear some insider language, some InterVarsity staff speak. There's maybe 5 or 10 minutes of that. I think that could be really interesting to you if you're looking in from the outside. There's also going to be this in-depth conversation about creativity, leadership during this disruption. I think it's going to be really helpful for you.
You're known for many things. You're an author, you're an editor, speaker, blogger, podcaster. What's your favorite way of being introduced?
Well, obviously, my favorite way to be introduced is former InterVarsity staff, because I did that for 10 years, and maybe in some ways the most wonderful 10 years of my life right out of college. I don't know. When I'm introduced these days, I mean, I'm a journalist, I guess, still, even though I don't work in journalism, which just means taking complicated things and trying to make them clear as quickly as possible. So you can call me a journalist.
That's awesome. So you were on staff for about 10 years. And so as all staff conversations go, we need to do the obligatory. What is your Myers-Briggs type? And what is your Enneagram? And what does that say about you?
Yeah, so Myers-Briggs INFJ, which is the least common type. So, you know, they aren't evenly distributed. So we are less than 1% of the population. And the place to find us at any large gathering of people is out on the balcony or out on the patio. We're always at the edge having deep, meaningful conversations. While the rest of you are superficially socializing, the handful of INFJs somehow find one another always at the edges and get talking. It's amazing how often I've met fellow INFJs in that spot. Yeah, Enneagram, I have to admit my entire knowledge of the Enneagram is based on Ian Cronin and Suzanne Stabile's book, which is, of course, a very beginner introduction. But when I read it, it became very clear what I was in that system, which is, I think you would call it a one-wing nine. So as a one, I really like things to be in order, but as a nine, I really like harmony. And so even though I want things to be in order, I won't necessarily tell you because I want to preserve the peace. Whereas a kind of a sheer one, I guess, would just sort of confront anything that's not in order. So one wing nine felt very real and very accurate in describing both the strength and kind of shadow side of my, of who I am. What are you?
Oh, your goodness. You're going to ask me back because you interview as well. You know, when you were saying what your Enneagram was, I heard the slight cringe of like, oh, this is me, which I feel like it's what makes the Enneagram accurate is when we realize what our number is and have that cringe like, oh, not the prettiest. So for me, I'm a 3-wing 4.
You'll have to give me a quick gloss on what that is and why it makes you cringe a bit.
All about productivity, all about looking shiny, for the lack of a better word, being impressive. And then you also have this internal 4 thing where you just are broody, often on the inside.
This is the artist, right?
Yes. Yeah. But then the 3 judges the 4, like, what's wrong with you? Why do you have emotions? And so it's a cringy existence often for me.
Well, the Enneagram, I think, is best used as a tool for a kind of humility, right? A way of just knowing ourselves in who and what we are without pride or anything but just accepting, this is kind of how I'm wired.
So I hear you say that you loved your time being on staff with InterVarsity, and that seems to have shaped you for a long time. How has your staff experience continued to shape how you view Jesus, how you do ministry?
Gosh, I don't know who I would be if I hadn't had those 10 years. Couple things. I mean, one, very simply, like many folks, though, I know we do ministry in many different ways within the InterVarsity movement, but the cornerstone of our work with students, all 10 years that I was on staff, was a year-long study of the Gospel of Mark in manuscript form. And I don't think there's anything more formative I've done in my entire life than year after year for 10 years, start on page one, the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and go to the end and see how the word is living and active. I mean, it just was revolutionary for me in every way. So certainly that. I would also say that maybe a little more subtly, the place where I was on staff was Harvard University, or Harvard College, technically, the undergraduate part. So a place of great privilege and so forth. And I think when I started, I really wondered, you know, given the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in Luke's version, could God work in a place that is the very, very opposite of poor? Materially poor. And I think seeing how God worked among those with tremendous tailwinds of privilege and surrounded by power, and yet if we were willing to be poor in spirit, which is the other version of that beatitude, that God would show up in really powerful ways, was very transforming for me. I still believe God is found among those who are poor. God's found among those who are brokenhearted. But there is a way, even in the midst of tremendous privilege, to access that reality if you are willing to forsake everything. So I think experiencing that in a really visceral way. And then I would say those were 10 years in the 1990s, so that was a long time ago. And the one amazing thing about getting older is seeing the fruit of that over, you know, the better part of a lifetime now, and still being in such deep relationship with so many people that we walked alongside as students at that time.
You wrote two articles, Love in the Time of the Coronavirus and Leading Beyond the Blizzard. And what I love about what you write is that you hold so many tensions really well, right? Being both compassionate and courageous, facing reality and not panicking. For you, what tensions have you found particularly challenging to hold?
At the very personal level, I would say it's grief and hope. Many dimensions of this. I think the very first part that hit me is my daughter is actually a college student right now. Very suddenly, within 24 hours, on March 12th, that whole campus learned that they would have to leave as soon as feasible. So my very first reaction to this as an empty nest parent was just sheer joy. Like, oh, my daughter's coming home. There's nowhere I want my daughter more than home at a moment like this. You know, it was almost literally driving onto that campus to pick her up that Saturday morning and realizing everything she was losing. And that while for me, this was this wonderful reunion of a sense, and but that for her and for, you know, 12,000 undergrads at that school, and then multiply that all over the country, just the loss of so much thriving, at least that was happening in my daughter's life, including Christian fellowship. But then the following Monday, I really was realizing what this meant. And that's the subject in many ways of the second piece, Leading Beyond the Blizzard, which, you know, the basic idea where this is not just a snow day. It's not even just a season. It's a total change from which we will emerge with a completely different world in certain important ways. Not in every way, but in important ways. And specifically realizing I'm a public speaker. I mean, I said at the top, I'm a journalist, but The other thing I love is speaking, teaching. I'm also a musician. And realizing I am not going to get to do that in front of an audience, maybe, I mean, for years, conceivably. And I sat down, got up that Monday morning and sat down and just wept for probably half an hour. But this was a death to the world that I knew and the work that I did and the thing I, in some ways, most loved. So that grief on also wanting to embrace hope that there is something for us to do in this reality, even today, even as we speak, you're locked down, I'm locked down, about a third of the country is told to stay at home, that even within these constraints, there's something we can do. So somehow putting those two things together is probably the deepest tension, I think, that I feel personally and that we all have to shepherd people through to the extent that we're pastors and teachers and leaders of others.
It almost feels like a decision. Do I put all my energies towards being creative, taking ministry online? There's so much to do there, and giving time for my own, like what you said, grief or my personal reaction or my stress or my anxiety. What have you done that's helped you hold that in a more manageable way?
Providentially, about 6 months ago now, one of our team at Praxis, the organization I work for now, gave an incredible workshop for one of our groups on the role of lament in creativity. These are two things that you don't think go together. Lament and creativity sound different. And even as you very naturally put it, like we tend to think, well, I need to be really working on creating here, but I've also got this grief. And what Donna gave us, and this was months ago, none of us were thinking virus, but she said, real creativity begins with lament. And she gave us this template for lament, a kind of a pattern that synthesizes the different psalms of lament. And, you know, very briefly, the elements are crying out to God, complaining to God. Complaint is actually part of the work of lament. Affirming trust in God, petitioning God, bringing requests before God. But the next item in her list was what she called additional argument. additional argument being, and also, you know, so the psalmist is maybe saying, you know, my life's in danger, don't you notice? That's the complaint. But then the additional argument is, don't you know that the pagans are never going to praise your name, God? Like, if you don't act, not just my life, but your fame is going to be endangered, you know? So you're allowed to make additional arguments. And then rage. So outrage, a sense of just betrayal, whether from other people or from God himself. And then yet ending with what she called assurance and promise. And she encouraged us to actually begin any work of creativity with the composition of a lament. Now, at that time, I was getting ready to work on a book, my next book, which I'm still working on. And so I actually wrote down a lament. I have it sitting on my desk just in view as we speak, and it has all those elements, and I actually read it aloud every day as I sit down to work on my book. And this gets, I think, to the situation we're all in now, which is that we all have much to lament, and it is actually right that we lament. And when we lament well, we bring the grief and the loss and the rage and the complaint into the context of relationship with God, also of hope and assurance and promising our lives to God. And I will just tell you, I've been practicing this for several months now as I've been working on the book. It's just amazing how it frees me to be creative because I'm not repressing things. I think the danger with trying to like, oh, I just need to focus on my work right now is, well, how can you focus on your work when your world is collapsing and being rearranged like hour by hour? And you don't actually have to play that like keeping the beach ball under the water game. You can actually bring it into God's presence, and somehow it actually unleashes capacity for creativity.
Yeah, I really resonate with what you were saying about not repressing things when you're trying to get things done. I had a day last week where I was so unfocused. And I don't know if anyone's ever done this, but you just keep looking at your email inbox like every 15 minutes and you're not quite sure what to do. And I called a friend. She said to me, maybe it's time to call it a day. It was mid-afternoon. And I was like, you're probably right. Like, it's not going to do me any good to just keep looking at my email inbox, being totally focused. So I called it a day and went to go hang out with my son a little bit more.
This is not a moment where sheer hours are going to get us what we need, right? But in terms of our creative calling, especially our leadership calling, there are going to be flashes of insight that will come from, I believe, from the Spirit. But that's happened to me two times in the last couple of weeks that led to these two pieces you read, these big, long pieces, which did, of course, then require hours of work. But they came from, I mean, moments of sitting and weeping. I have never been so undisciplined in what you described about checking the email as I have in the past week or so. But the moments when I've been able to say, well, I just need to go out and walk outside and or do the dishes or, you know, because really what we're waiting for is really, I would say, prophetic imagination to be and prophetic, you know, in the biblical mindset is not just foretelling the future. It's actually just accurately naming the present. That's only something that comes when we're kind of fully available to God. And we're only fully available when we're rested, when we've had our moment of rage. That's what we are needing to attend to God and what His Spirit is doing in us for right now.
And as we look, not just in the next month, but the next half year or so, there's just going to be so many opportunities for creativity, trying new things. And university staff, if you know, they are tremendously creative. The things that they put out with the college students blows my mind all the time. And something that you write about in some of your books is about idolatry of the good things that God gives us. What might idolatry of creativity look like? And how do we guard ourselves against that?
So I suppose there would be a couple warning signs. Like, what are the early warning signs of idolatry? My understanding of idolatry is it's always about the quest for control. So I do think that, like every good thing, that our creative capacities can be a way of evading the suffering that we're actually experiencing, or of seeking a kind of control over our circumstances, over other people, even over our own emotions. And we can like plunge ourselves into certain kinds of work to distract from the things that are actually before us. In a way, whenever you feel like you're getting more in control, there's probably an aspect of an idol that's creeping in there. Not that it's bad to have authority. It's just bad to have authority without vulnerability, right? And then I think the other just recurring diagnostic for idolatry is, what is this doing to my relationships? Because idols separate us from our relationship with God and our relationship with other people. They want to divide us. They want to isolate us. I'm experiencing this very viscerally living in our home with my wife and my daughter for this season. And we're here all the time. And I can sense my desire to retreat into my work and into my workspace to avoid the difficult work of being in relationship with these two people who I theoretically love very much. And I mean, it's just, I'm tempted to use it to hide from the relationships I've actually been given.
Which in this current situation can feel like years because so much happens every day. And so since you wrote it, what are you feeling even more certain of today than 5 days ago?
Yeah, so the premise of the piece is that we are tempted to think of this just as a kind of a blizzard, a snow day. It's going to pass. We'll emerge. The snow plows will have done their work. We'll be back in it. And that's in the matter of days or weeks. And it's definitely not that. It's more like winter, which is a season. But then the real goal of the piece is to kind of push leaders a little bit and say, but what if this is more like an ice age or more like 1816, which was called the year without a summer, the year when there was no summer in the Northern Hemisphere? And what if we're talking 21 months, which is the kind of time frame of the Imperial College London study for the suppression of the virus? So what am I more sure of? Well, I'll say the thing I'm a little less sure of is how this is going to play out in terms of policies that will be imposed on us. Because The Ice Age scenario lends itself to the idea of everything being frozen. And that is very much how our economy is today, as you and I are speaking. I mean, in an literally unprecedented way, like never in history, even in the Great Depression or at any time, has the world economy been frozen in quite the way it is. And an Ice Age would sort of lend you to think, well, it's just going to stay frozen. And so would the most natural strategies for suppression of the virus. They require a lot of staying at home, sheltering in place, freezing. Whether there is going to be the political will for this is probably feels less certain to me than it did even a few days ago. Now, what that means for the course of the epidemic, what it means for our economy is complex. So I'm a little less sure of exactly how it's going to play out. What I am more and more sure of is the level of disruption to the institutions and systems around us that we felt that we could take for granted just a few weeks ago. I don't think anyone can be a prophet right now. We can't really foretell, except that it's going to be radically different. It will be many years before there's a new normal. And in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of turbulence, some weird combination of things being totally frozen and things being totally unpredictable and random in a way.